At Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a truly monumental work, really foundational to American history and social thought, W.B. Du Bois' 1903 masterpiece, The Souls of Black Folk.
It really is. And it's amazing how relevant it still feels, written, you know, at probably the lowest point for African-American rights after Reconstruction ended.
Right. It wasn't just history even then, was it? It felt more like an intellectual blueprint.
Absolutely. I mean, it was revolutionary. Du Bois gave this incredibly sophisticated and frankly unflinching look at the African-American experience in post-slavery America.
Yeah.
He wasn't just like describing a situation. He was articulating this whole political, economic, psychological reality that, let's be honest, white America was predetermined to ignore.
And he sets the stage right away, doesn't he? That incredibly prophetic line at the start, where he just states, plain as day, that the core problem of the entire 20th century, it's the problem of the color line.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about everything that came after the World War, civil rights, everything, it just defined the era. It's chilling, almost.
It was such a crucial framing. Because by saying the color line, he shifted the focus, didn't he?
Mm.
It wasn't that black people were somehow the problem, which was the racist thinking of the time.
Right.
Instead, the problem was this systemic racial division that America just wouldn't confront.
So let's talk about the man himself.
Sure.
Who exactly was W.E.B. Du Bois?
Well, William Edward Burghardt Du Bois, a towering figure, lived an incredibly long life, 1868 to 1963. And just hugely influential.
Or incredibly educated, right?
Oh, massively. Arguably one of the most educated Americans of his time, period.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first African-American to get a PhD from Harvard.
Wow.
Yeah. And before that, Fisk University. And then he did intense academic work in Germany at the University of Berlin. This guy wasn't just, you know, an armchair scholar. He was a pioneer in American sociology.
He'd already published the Philadelphia Negro before this, hadn't he?
Exactly. In 1899, 4 years earlier. Already establishing this rigorous, data-driven approach.
So, top-tier academic credentials.
Mm.
But lots of people studied race then. What made his perspective and soul so different, so distinctive?
That's the fascinating part, I think. He had this unique fusion, this blend of perspectives. On one hand, you have the meticulous, detached scholar trained in Germany, the precision data, objectivity.
Okay.
But then you have the deeply personal lived experience of a black man in America living behind what he so powerfully called the veil.
Ah, the veil. We'll definitely come back to that.
Right. So he's both the objective analyst looking from the outside and the subjective participant feeling it from the inside. He's writing from the ivory tower, maybe, mm-hmm. but he's writing about the soul. It's that combination.
Let's dive into the book itself then, The Souls of Black Folk. It's tricky to pin down, isn't it? It's not just one thing.
No, it really resists easy labels,
mm-hmm.
which is part of his brilliance, I think. It's this amazing mix. You've got history, sociology, poetry, even autobiography woven together.
It feels like it's doing several jobs at once.
It really is. You could say it operates on maybe three levels.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely meant as a validation, a powerful affirmation for Black Americans themselves.
Okay.
But it's also a direct, sharp confrontation aimed at white Americans, challenging their ignorance and complicity. And then, on a bigger stage, it's like an international indictment of America's hypocrisy on race.
And politically, it felt really urgent, like an intervention. He wasn't just describing the problem. He was pushing for a specific solution.
Absolutely. He lays out the central thesis. Real progress needs three things: full political rights, full civil rights, and access to higher education.
And why was he so insistent on those three right then?
Because the dominant voice at the time, Booker T. Washington, who was incredibly powerful.
An Atlanta Compromise guy.
Exactly. Washington was basically saying, look, Black Americans should focus on vocational training, get good jobs, build economic stability, and sort of set aside the demands for political power and civil rights for now. Appease the white South, gain economic footing first.
And Du Bois saw that as?
As a disastrous mistake, a dangerous compromise. He fundamentally believed that giving up political and civil rights, even temporarily, would just lock in subordination.
It makes sense. What good is economic progress if you have no power to protect it or yourself?
Precisely. That's exactly Du Bois' point. Sacrificing those rights meant sacrificing dignity, sacrificing real equality. So he counters Washington's sort of accommodationist view with this idea of the talented 10th.
The talented 10th. Explain that.
It's the idea that the black community needed a college-educated elite, the top 10%, roughly to provide leadership, intellectual guidance, and essentially spearhead the fight for full equality. They would be the vanguard.
Okay, so that sets up the core tension. Let's get into some of the specific ideas, starting with maybe his most famous contribution, right there in chapter one, double consciousness.
Yes.
Foundational.
How did he actually describe this psychological weight? And how does it connect to that other key metaphor you mentioned, the veil?
Double consciousness.
Yeah.
He describes it as this internal struggle, almost like a civil war within the black soul. His words are unforgettable. Two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body.
Wow.
It's this constant feeling of seeing yourself, but also seeing yourself through the eyes of a society that despises or pities you. You're always looking at yourself through this other, often hostile lens.
And the veil is what creates that distortion.
Exactly. The veil is the barrier. It's both social and psychological. For Black people, it means being constantly watched, judged, having to navigate carefully what we might call code switching today.
Mm-hmm. But for white Americans, the veil makes Black people invisible as full human beings. They're seen only as stereotypes or as problems. It prevents any real mutual understanding. It's like a thick screen between the races.
Okay, so from that deep psychological insight, let's shift to the more systemic stuff he analyzed. He really dug into the economics of the rural South, right? The Black Belt.
Oh, yeah. Chapter 7 and 8, for instance, go deep into places like Dougherty County, Georgia. It's rigorous sociological work. He's looking at sharecropping and this system called debt peonage.
And what did his data show? Was it just bad luck for Black farmers?
No, not at all. He meticulously showed it was basically a system of economic fraud designed to replace slavery. Sharecropping depended on the croplean system.
How did that work?
Farmers, usually Black farmers, had to get seeds, tools, everything on credit from the landowner or a local merchant, almost always white. But that merchant also controlled the bookkeeping and set the price when the cotton was sold.
So a completely rigged market.
Totally rigged. The accounts were manipulated, so the farmer almost never cleared their debt, no matter how good the harvest was. Year after year, they fell deeper into debt.
Which leads to debt peonage.
Right. It becomes this inescapable cycle. You're legally bound to work the land for the person you owe money to forever. Du Bois showed this wasn't just some unfortunate consequence of poverty. It was an intentional system to keep Black farmers poor, landless, and dependent. A new form of bondage.
That kind of systemic track really underlines why he was so passionate about education, doesn't it? Chapter 6 makes this powerful case for liberal arts, not just the vocational training Washington focused on.
Absolutely. For Du Bois, education wasn't just about getting a job. It was about liberation. Mental liberation.
Well, so?
He argued that focusing only on vocational skills, as Washington suggested, basically accepted the racist idea that Black people were only suited for manual labor.
Mm.
But liberal arts history, philosophy, literature that cultivates critical thinking. It develops leaders.
Yeah.
It nurtures the intellectual capacity needed to challenge the veil, to understand and dismantle systems like debt peonage, to argue effectively for rights. Education was dignity. It was resistance.
And he was so good at weaving that kind of analysis together with incredibly personal moments. Chapter 11 of The Passing of the Firstborn is just devastating.
It really is. Probably the most famous autobiographical part of the book, he writes about the death of his infant son, Burghardt.
It's incredibly raw.
It is. He shares the overwhelming grief, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's this shocking, painful moment of reflection where he admits to feeling a kind of perverse relief.
Relief.
Relief that his son would be spared. The pain, the insults, the sheer weight of growing up Black behind the veil in America is just a gut punch, showing how racism poisons even the most profound love.
And that personal loss kind of echoes in the fictional story he tells later, doesn't it? The parable of John Jones in chapter 13.
Yes. The young man who gets educated up north comes back south, full of awareness and ideas.
And that very awareness becomes dangerous.
Exactly. His education, his consciousness, leads directly to a fatal clash with the Jim Crow system. It starkly illustrates the tragic, sometimes deadly, cost of striving for knowledge and dignity in that world.
But he doesn't leave us just with tragedy. The book ends on a different note, right? Chapter 14, focusing on the Black church and the sorrow songs.
Right, the spirituals. And he doesn't just treat them like, you know, folk music or historical curiosities.
No, he elevates them.
He absolutely elevates them. He calls them a world-class art form, maybe the most authentic expression of the American soul. He sees them as this incredible chronicle of suffering, yes, but also of resilience, deep faith, and this uncrushable hope for freedom. They were the bedrock, the spiritual and cultural glue holding the community together.
So if we pull back and look at the whole book, what are maybe the top three big enduring themes that you think still really speak to us today?
Okay, number one, without a doubt, has to be double consciousness and the veil.
Still so relevant.
Incredibly. It's arguably the most powerful framework we have for understanding all sorts of identity issues, even now.
Mm.
You think about things like code switching in professional settings or feelings of imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Those are direct echoes of navigating that two-ness, that dual identity, especially for minorities in predominantly white spaces.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, theme number two.
I'd say the whole debate around full citizenship versus accommodation, that clash with Booker T. Washington.
What's the takeaway there for, say, social movements today?
The lesson I think Du Bois would argue is that real lasting progress demands fighting for fundamental rights, political civil right, from the outset, uncompromisingly.
Don't settle.
Exactly. Accepting compromises that leave the basic power structures untouched, like Washington seemed willing to do, just risks prolonging the inequality. Du Bois really teaches the value of demanding the non-negotiable.
Okay, and a third key theme.
Cultural pride and heritage. Du Bois makes such a strong case that Black culture, the church, the music, the unique forms of resilience and spirituality isn't secondary or something to be ashamed of.
Right.
It's an invaluable contribution to American culture as a whole. And crucially, it's a vital source of strength, community, and self-worth, completely independent of white approval or validation.
The book is also just packed with memorable lines, isn't it? Phrases that have really entered the lexicon.
Oh, absolutely. Lines written over 120 years ago that still feel foundational to how we talk about race and society in America.
Let's highlight a few. We already mentioned the big one. The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. Just nails the central conflict.
Concise, prophetic, and depressingly accurate for much of the century.
And then the core definition of that internal split. One ever feels his two-ness. An American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings. That captures it perfectly.
It really does, that feeling of internal fragmentation forced by external oppression.
But importantly, his goal wasn't to stay fragmented, was it? He aimed for integration.
Right. He writes that the goal is, he simply wishes to make it possible for a man to be both a Negro and an American. It's a plea for wholeness, for a unified identity that's respected within the larger society. Not assimilation, but respected coexistence.
And one more, really highlighting that intersection of race and class. To be a poor man is hard, but to be a poor race in a land of dollars is the very bottom of hardships.
Hmm. That just cuts right to the bone, doesn't it? It nails the compounded burden, how systemic poverty feels different, deeper, when it's tied to racial marginalization.
So how can we apply these ideas today, thinking about real life situations?
Well, one area is definitely workplace diversity and inclusion.
How so?
The concept of the veil is super relevant. It helps explain why just, you know, hiring more diverse candidates isn't enough.
Right. It's not just about numbers.
No. Companies need to think about the experience of minority employees. That feeling of hypervisibility, the pressure, the potential judgment, the psychological burden Du Bois described. Real inclusion means creating psychological safety, letting people be authentic, not just present.
That makes a lot of sense. What about the education piece?
His passionate defense of the liberal arts feels more relevant than ever, right? In a world obsessed with job training and specific skills.
Yes, STEM.
Right. Du Bois reminds us that education is also about developing critical thinking, leadership potential, and achieving a kind of mental freedom. It's not just about being useful to an employer. It's about becoming a fully realized human being and citizen.
And I think that idea of double consciousness has a broader application too, doesn't it? Beyond just the Black experience in America.
Absolutely. I think it offers a powerful lens for empathy. Anyone who's ever had to navigate being part of a minority group, maybe an immigrant community, a religious minority, LGBTQ plus individuals, while also being part of a dominant national culture.
They might recognize that feeling of two-ness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That need to reconcile different identities, sometimes conflicting ones. Du Bois gives us a language for understanding that complex negotiation, which is pretty universal in diverse societies.
Mm. So as we wrap up, what's the one thing that really stood out for you from revisiting Souls of Black Folk for this deep dive?
For me, I think it's that incredible blend he achieves. You have this rigorous, almost detached sociological analysis, the data on sharecropping, the history of the Freedmen's Bureau.
Yeah, the scholar.
Right. But then woven right into it, you have these moments of profound, almost painful vulnerability, like writing about his son's death. It just makes the abstract arguments about politics and economics feel intensely human, immediately relatable. It's that fusion that makes it so powerful, I think.
I agree. What struck me this time is how clearly he saw that racism isn't just one thing. It's not just laws or just economics. It works on all these levels at once. The legal system, the economic exploitation, yes. But also the psychological damage, the veil, the double consciousness and the cultural dimension, the need for pride and spiritual strength. He showed that the struggle for justice has to be fought everywhere, simultaneously. Political, economic, educational, and cultural. It's a total fight.
A truly holistic vision, even back then. It's why it remains such a central reading.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.